This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. Throughout this revolution, there have been a lot of discussions and exploration of the, yeah, but what about, when it comes to keeping patients awake and mobile throughout critical illness. Some of the most common what abouts that I hear are, what about substance withdrawal? What about patients with baseline psychopathologies? What about patients with agitation? Some of the best experts in this are psychiatrists. Inpatient psych consistently manages patients with these conditions and can be incredible supportive resources for our ICU teams. I have had wonderful relationships and experiences with consulting with inpatient psych and am excited to discuss this further with Dr. Marie Ruvie, psychiatrist and fellow ICU revolutionist. Dr. Ruvie, welcome to the podcast. Can you introduce yourself to us?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me. My name is Marie Ruvie. I'm a psychiatrist in Ohio, work at a large academic medical center in Ohio. And I'm actually specifically a consult liaison psychiatrist. So in psychiatry, that's a subspecialty area. Unlike I think a lot of other areas of medicine, like the intensivists that I work with, they sort of rotate through consults as part of all their usual responsibilities. And in psychiatry, considering that figuring some of these out, these psychiatric syndromes and such out in the medically ill population, it's actually a separate board certification to do consults in the hospital for psychiatry. So I have been doing this for, consult psychiatry for about 15 years, psychiatry overall for 20. And I do have a special love for the ICU and trying to figure out all the mysteries that go on in critical care.
And it's not that common to have psychiatrists that are specialized or really invested or involved in the ICU. How did that come to be for you?
So in one of my previous positions at a medical center in Pennsylvania where I was doing consult work, of course, there's a lot of delirium in ICUs, right? We know that. And that's probably the thing that consult psychiatrists are most often asked to see patients about, is some form or syndrome of delirium, right? Agitation, hallucinations, pulling at lines and tubes, unable to cooperate with needed care, things like that. So I would see patients in the ICUs, but the intensivists at that hospital were actually very interested in all things related to the PAD guidelines, which had just come out in 2013. And a couple of them were very interested in whatever help they could get to the better practices for pain, agitation, and delirium, you know, sort of addressed and set up in their ICU. So I was asked to help with a lot of that. That gave me great experience, lots of confidence, you know, working with intensivists, like a comfort level, right? Because it's a little bit of a different arena. I feel like sometimes there's a kind of a wall between critical care and psychiatry. It can be a little hard to break into. We sometimes don't understand each other and our backgrounds, where we're coming from. So building those relationships can be kind of tough, but I kind of took that experience into the current medical center here, which of course, we also had COVID overlaid on top of that, right? So when I came here, it was actually in May of 2020 at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, and they were in the thick of it here. So starting to get asked to see a lot of consults for delirium in the ICU who were already on, you know, multiple sedative agents, opiates, basically RAS -5 in a lot of cases, or sometimes I say, you know, RAS 100, depending, minus 100, and being asked to, you know, add drugs onto these patient cases, which was kind of mystifying for me. And then when I would start to ask about, what about spontaneous awakening trials? What's been happening with those, or CAM, or any of these other kinds of things, I would get sort of blank stares back. I think there was at that time a lot of travel nurses, a lot of just general chaos going on. And so I was trying to help as much as I could, but eventually had to start investigating, you know, really based on my experience, what I learned, what had, you know, come, I sort of came up at the same time that this whole ICU Liberation Collaborative was going on. It's like all of these practices, everything we're reading about, all the safety and mortality benefits and things, we don't really seem to be totally on board with all that, or we need to get back on board with it after COVID. So I started talking to the individual disciplines like physical and occupational therapy, the nurse managers in the unit, the head of RT, the critical care pharmacist that we have here, a couple of the intensivists. And there seemed to be enough threshold of interest and like, yeah, we do need to be doing this stuff. Some of this stuff has gotten so off track with COVID. We need to sort of resurrect things, get things back on the right, that we formed like a steering committee. I call it the ICU Liberation Committee here, involves all the disciplines. And that was about 2 years ago. And we've slowly been trying to just re-implement all the practices and get everything back up to speed.
Those that are listening may think, I don't think I've ever seen psychiatry go show up to the RT lounge.
Yeah.
Or the RT offices and chat. Like that is a really unique phenomenon, because you're right. We are so siloed, so isolated within our disciplines, but even departments. And you're creating this role of psychiatry in the ICU. And I love that you really catch the vision. You are integrating all of the disciplines, bringing everyone to the table. I've seen dietitians do that. Mm-hmm. I've seen anyone can bring in the team to the table and say, hey, we're not practicing best practices. And this is very relevant to what you're doing. If you're there to treat delirium, you do have a right to be discussing sedation and mobility practices and all of this. But I imagine that there were some eyebrows raised. It probably seemed a little out of your quote scope initially, but hopefully your team has caught on. And if you could build the dream role or position for psychiatry in the ICU, how would you define that and what would that be?
Yeah, I feel like I'm close to it because I feel like psychiatry is very well positioned to help with all of these ICU liberation efforts, which of course affect everything that the ICU cares about, right? So, you know, when you think about pain, agitation, delirium, you go into the PADIS guidelines, immobility, sleep, maybe more quote minor symptoms, although I don't think they're minor to patients, like anxiety and things like that. And then sort of on a meta level, you know, we're talking about behavior change and culture change among clinicians. I think all of those things, psychiatry lends itself very well to being able to understand all of those different aspects of the liberation bundle and bring everybody together and try to work on team and collaboration and understanding and getting down to the reconnecting a little bit with the why. Why are we all doing this? Why are we here? What kind of ICU do we all want to practice in? And what does that take? You know, Dr. Ely is extremely inspiring, and I get a lot of inspiration from him in terms of, you know, why are we all here? What did we all show up to work for? What did we get into these professions for? And trying to help with bringing all that up to the surface a little bit. So facilitating discussions and things. So from my perspective, the perfect ICU psychiatry job is to be part of that team, to be working on all these elements of the bundle, to be kind of, I do kind of a combination of attending ICU rounds every day, which I did have to invite myself to, but eventually they, you know, let me be there. And then slowly I got to have the floor a little bit more and things like that. But at ICU rounds, I can kind of get, I can kind of listen through an ICU liberation lens, or a PADIS lens, right? So they're all focused on a lot of different things at the bedside, antibiotics, anticoagulation, all these kinds of things. And I can listen through the liberation lens as to how is all this coming together? What are the barriers toward extubating this person? And a lot of times that lies somewhere in sedation, agitation, anxiety, and all those kinds of things that we can kind of fix. How did their spontaneous awakening trial and breathing trial go? If it didn't go well, what was the problem and how can we fix the problem? And how can we think outside of our typical kind of sedation box to other tools that could fix the problem? So I have those kind of discussions on the fly. I can adjust, the intensivists have sort of accepted me enough that I can adjust the pain regimen, the sleep medications, the things like that kind of on the fly while we're standing there at rounds. Sometimes I get formally consulted, especially if there's like more complicated psychiatric history, there's substance use overlay that's creating kind of a big mess, things like that. I've also taken to consulting myself on a few of these cases, which is also evidence-based in the world of consult psychiatry. There is such a thing as proactive consultation, because sometimes the mystery is just like, I don't know, you know, as an intensivist, I don't know who would benefit from seeing a psychiatrist, or I don't know, I've got this mess of a situation. Does it have anything to do with psychiatry? What can you do? I don't know. So,
and it's part of that rooted in delirium being so common.
Yeah.
I feel like it's these symptoms that those of us that understand delirium, we understand the big picture. We see those symptoms as very concerning. This is going to put their cognitive and psychological safety in the long run at danger, but they don't necessarily see it as such a concern. It's like, well, they're encephalopathic. It's fine. They'll get over it later. It's not a big deal, but you see the problem. So I think there is benefit to having someone looking at the big picture and saying, no, 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 this is not something we just shrug our shoulders and endure. This is something that needs to be treated now.
Right. Yeah. And it being so prevalent, and it's getting worse, right? I know that we talk a lot in these circles about the fact that sedation, as it's traditionally understood, is basically deliriogenic. And so, you know, I can sort of see that this person in the ICU has all these risk factors for delirium, right? I think the average patient in the ICU has 11 different risk factors for becoming delirious. And maybe they're starting and with a little bit of confusion, or they're up during the night or whatever it is. And they're on, you know, so we've treated it, quote, with these, you know, IV sedatives that we're giving people. But I can see that, well, I might as well just jump in on this case now, because 2 to 3 days from now, we're going to be like really rollicking, full of delirium, agitation, pulling at tubes, lines, hitting people and the whole rest of it. So let me just get involved now. We can help with some other ways of managing this stuff. We can get rid of this, all these things that are deleriogenic in terms of some of the standard ways to address it in the ICU. Coming from outside of the ICU, psychiatry into the ICU, it's like, to me, delirium is the same, whether it's on the geriatric floor, it's in the emergency department, it's on, you know, the cardiovascular step-down unit, or it's in the ICU. But what I've observed is that the ways to address it in the ICU are different somehow, you know, or thought to be different. Like, this is a different phenomenon. Like, to me, it's really the same phenomenon. It's the same acute brain dysfunction, the same strategies to treat it, which include avoiding medications that worsen it, apply inside and outside the ICU. So that's where I get kind of myself involved.
I've had almost some audible gasps when I've said at a conference, and maybe this wasn't appropriate, I don't know. But I shared the analogy, giving sedation in response to delirium is like giving bacteria in response to sepsis.
Yes.
And exactly. That probably sounds like a really crude and harsh way to say it, but is it potentially that black and white?
Yes. And I've thought about similar like analogies, like how can I make you understand what I'm saying? And I've tried to come up with like for giving benzos for delirium, because they seem to work a little bit, right, when you first give it to them. So I sort of think of like a patient in renal failure who's anuric, and they want them to make urine. And it's like, a benzo is like a nurse saying, well, I have this medication that's going to produce some urine, and they want urine, you know, being made. That's great. But it's ultimately going to worsen the renal failure. So would we give that medication, you know, just to produce urine when actually we're wrecking the kidneys in the process? And that's a little bit of benzos and delirium, right? They seem to kind of calm everything down initially, but they're adding their poison basically to the brain, and they're adding to the delirium. And somebody, as you've said before, is going to pay for that down the road. The grenade's going to go off.
Okay, that is one of my analogies. You start sedation, right? Maybe right upon intubation, you bite off the grenade and you're passing it down shift to shift, and it's going to fall on somebody to have to take it off. And then you unmask this delirium. And it's, from the nursing perspective, it is very stressful, difficult, exhausting, sometimes traumatic to deal with. One study showed that delirium is one of the main psychological burdens on nurses. And I absolutely appreciate that.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think that's one area where the ICU nurses here have seem to appreciate my help on cases is because, you know, if I start talking about sedation and how that's terrible for delirium and we can't be like dripping all this stuff into these people 24/7, and the conversation ends there, the nurses are like, yeah, but, you know, what am I supposed to do with people? And so, you know, we have some other tools, right? We have some as needed medications. We have things that we've used for agitation for a long time. And I definitely am trying to change the culture to think more toward non-pharmacologic interventions also, which would include early mobility, which I agree in my experience, just like the 2019 ICU collaborative study show, like that's the hardest part to get going. That's the hardest part to make people believe on the team that this is going to help. You know, this is a treatment for delirium. I wanted to get our physical therapist a little badge for their coat or lanyard that says, you know, I am the treatment.
Delirium SWAT team.
Yes, I am the delirium SWAT team. That would be even better. I am the treatment. I have to go in there. I struggle somewhat with less familiar PTs and OTs thinking that they can't work with somebody who can't follow commands. You know, I get that a lot. But actually, we have to have the conversation about like, how can I help? Let's do what we can here. But some form of working with them on mobility is going to help their brain. So,
yeah, I was going to ask you how you felt about that being written in some of the policies and parameters for mobility. In some of these facilities that I've seen, it's a requirement that patients follow commands to be a candidate for early mobility.
Yes, I am totally against that. I can clearly say that. And that was, so the physical therapist who spent a lot of time in the ICU was the first conversation with a discipline that I had back a couple of years ago. And that's basically one of the first things he said is, well, we can't work with anyone who can't follow commands. And I was like, well, that explains a lot, but we're going to have to, you know, I didn't say it to him right then, but, you know, the conversation evolved over time that we're going to have to look at this from an evidence-based perspective, right? And we're going to have to see what other helps we have that can assist with agitation or keep people safe if they're not doing exactly what you tell them to every single time. But even just during the course of a mobility session with a delirious patient, they can become a lot better at following commands, right? If you're engaged with them, whatever they were doing at the beginning is not necessarily the status they're in at the end of the session. And so you can just see the treatment itself in front of you. So it's come a long way with the therapist in terms of presence in the ICU, eagerness. You know, I gave a talk, sort of a question and answer session to about 30 of our PTs and OTs about early mobility and just some of the science, the recent article that showed improved cognitive outcomes 1 year after early mobility in the ICU. And they're very passionate in their own right. So I think, again, once they feel like, oh yeah, it's not just me going in there and trying to deal with a person who can't follow commands as the physical or occupational therapist, but it's actually this whole team. They're all trying to attend to straightening out the thinking as much as possible, calming down the agitation, normalizing the daytime and the sleep-wake cycles, having the family at the bedside. The nurses are more aware of what's going on and how this might help them because I've spent a lot of time talking to them too. And so I think it's definitely moving in the right direction to the point where our physical therapists and occupational therapists advocated for and got approved that the bed rest order that's in the admission order set get removed replaced with progressive mobility order set from the beginning of ICU admission so that they can evaluate what's going on. And they've been working with a lot more folks. And actually the other week got one of our ventilated patients up and walking from the bed to the door, which was a huge accomplishment, went a long way in terms of ripples of excitement and motivation for all this going forward.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, I think this is very empowering to PTs and OTs where they can find their role and their place in the ICU. We allow them more autonomy. They can do more critical thinking. Of course, you know, especially in more difficult, tenuous critical cases, there needs to be more interdisciplinary collaboration. Mm-hmm. But I love it when PTs and OTs have the skill set and the competency to do their own assessments, even with those more difficult patients, to say, are they appropriate? Are they not? And advocate and discuss those things. But it's a process of conversion, of evolution I think that when we have these parameters that bar these experts from getting their job done, we just create a huge disservice for the entire team. I think it makes it much harder for the nurses, because then they are left to try to wrangle these thrashing, agitated patients while we have other people saying, don't hurt their brains with sedation. But then what do you do? So when teams say, we're just going to focus on sedation for now and we'll hit early mobility later, I think that's very difficult, because from a nursing perspective, if I don't have early mobility and now I have patients that are awake on the ventilator, and yeah, I've taken out one or two risk factors for delirium, but I'm not progressively or proactively preventing it with early mobility, then they're going to develop delirium at high rates even still, but I don't have anything to really control them or to keep the endotracheal tube and all the things that nurses are worried about. Yes. And I see that in these teams, when nurses are seeing PTs and OTs come in and help them, and they see the patients calm down and sleep afterwards, the nurses relax. They feel better. They feel like, okay, the patient is safer. I saw the benefit of that. And now I don't, my shift is so much easier because of them. So when we have parameters that make it so that patients cannot do early mobility, they can't follow commands, my analogy for that is not allowing for dialysis unless there's renal function happening.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It doesn't make sense.
Right. And I try to bring these topics of conversation up on ICU team rounds every day. So everybody's hearing the question, why wouldn't they be able to get physical therapy or occupational therapy today, right? And of course, our therapists are not at interprofessional rounds. So that's maybe a goal for the future, that they'd be there. You know, I'd love it to be reported out at rounds, you know, what's their highest level of mobility today and things like that. Right now, we're just at the level of, yes, PT and OT can come see them. And yes, they're not following commands or they were agitated overnight, but that doesn't mean that they couldn't be successful necessarily with PTOT today. So let's see what happens before we write that off. And let's be sure all these other parameters are in place too, like their RAS is appropriate. And we have maybe other medications or other non-pharmacologic interventions that are helping get the kind of agitation calmed down, the thinking a little straighter, the, you know, ability to engage a little bit better.
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more. Did you see, at least initially, some inconsistencies with the RAS and CAM scores and charting and reporting? What did you see, and how did you help address that?
Yes, we definitely have a wide variability with that. So we've done a lot of nursing education and it's still in process. This is another role that I feel like I have on ICU rounds, because we have a script that the nurses are asked to report off of for the bundle elements, and then a couple of other things that the nurse managers wanted added there. And that's been a big focus of our work, is just like setting out a model for this conversation to happen at interprofessional rounds. Because when I first started, it was quite disorganized. It was all over the place. The nurses were sort of left for the end and were kind of asked, you know, like this question, quote, need anything? And that's the end of it. You know, after all this discussion had been done and none of their input had been taken in or anything like that. So we formulated a list of things for the nurses to talk about, and the resident will introduce the case with like a one-liner of what they're there for. The nurse then goes into this bundle report, and then it goes back to the resident for discussing labs, consultations, you know, assessment plan for the day, things like that. So they have the script down pretty well in terms of like how to pass the conversation back and forth and who's supposed to say what, but we still do struggle with it being a little bit of a shell in terms of there's a wide variety in the nurse's comfort level with knowing what a RAS and a CAM even are, let alone a CPOD, which was extremely new to this ICU, and to correctly report those, to include those in the bundle and not, you know, report and not just skip over them, but then also to have them be accurate. And that's a little bit of what I try to help with on kind of a case-by-case basis when I'm at rounds. Not in front of everybody at rounds, but often like once the team has moved on to the next patient on the list, I will hang back for a few minutes if I feel like, you know, I can see from the doorway that this person's CAM is going to be positive, but we didn't report it that way. So can we just go back in and do a CAM together? Let's just see, you know, how it goes. And we just do the teaching right there at the bedside, or even more fundamentally with the RAS. You know, the RAS is -1, and I'm looking at the doorway like that patient is not. That patient's comatose. I have stopped the conversation at rounds somewhat and said, okay, so RAS is -1. So they're opening their eyes to voice and they are maintaining eye contact for more than 10 seconds. And the nurse will be like, no, they really didn't maintain eye contact. Did you have to touch them to wake them up? Yes. Well, that's a RAS of -4 pretty automatically. You know, if they're not responding to your voice, then we're below the -1, 2, 3. So kind of doing those kind of teachable moments for the whole team reinforces it somewhat. But yeah, I do have a lot of concerns, especially as we start to think about data collection and using the ICU liberation flow sheets and dashboards that are in Epic, that like, I'm not sure how accurate our actual data is going to be in there because of some of these. I've had nurses say, well, the patient's intubated, so I wasn't really able to do a CAM. So we have to have a teaching moment there. Or I've had a lot of nurses say the CAM is negative when clearly the CAM is positive. And it's almost like CAM negative means like, I don't know how to do the RAS, or I didn't know how to approach it. So it's like negative in terms of like, wasn't done. And I'm like, no, that's not what negative means. So it's there's been a lot of individual teaching moments, and that's going to go on. I tell the nurse manager there that this is going to be like a 20+ year project. Like we have to have the long-term vision here. We're going to have to continually educate and audit and model and demonstrate.
Right. Cause there's been a lot of damage done during COVID, and maybe we weren't as solid as we hoped we were even before COVID. So right. I think a lot of the nurses have not received formal training. Everything you've described, I've seen throughout most other teams. This is not isolated to your team at all. Yeah. I've had nurses, you know, during training say, wow, I've worked here for 18 months and no one ever taught me how to do a CAM. Yes. And they were new to the ICU. So we may be holding them accountable or expecting things that we never actually trained them to do, which is obviously unfair, but ultimately unsafe. Yeah. The RAS easily becomes whatever was charted beforehand, whatever is usually charted, whatever is prescribed. That very distinct point of if you have to touch them to arouse them, then it's a -4 or lower. That is a very misunderstood concept throughout the community. And so that alone is powerful. I mean, the way to impact outcomes in large part is educating our teams. And something I really try to focus on is what is our vision here? Why are these tools important? It's not just another thing to chart, because that's easy for nurses to perceive that we are just adding to their burden, more things to chart. It's just another thing to check off the list. I think they really miss the vision of the bundle. How do you feel like your team is perceiving the vision of the bundle, and what kind of things are you doing to try to help them understand the real why behind it?
Yeah, I tried to bring up the very well-established longer-term consequences from this, right? That while delirium is difficult for us to manage as staff in the hospital, this is actually brain failure and brain, you know, injury. That's what, you know, the group from Vanderbilt has clearly demonstrated, that we can think of the outcomes of delirium as an acquired dementia or equivalent to a mild to moderate brain injury. And that's going to affect the patient's work life, family life, personal life going forward from here on out. So I'm always trying to refocus us back on those bigger picture things, which gets back to a little bit like I was talking before, we were talking before recording about, you know, why is everybody here? Why come into the ICU? If we really, you know, don't care about this stuff, which is sometimes I feel like a reaction that you can get on a bad day where there's lots of codes or whatever, like, I don't have time for this. And all these other things are happening. It's like, but what did we all really show up for here? And what are we all really doing here to help patients? Is it more about thinking about survivorship, right? Like, not just whether people live or die on our shift, that's important, but what are they surviving to? What kind of life are they going to have going forward from here? And that we have very, you know, clear evidence basis for thinking that brain dysfunction being seen in the ICU is going to lead to brain dysfunction over time for at least a significant portion of people. We can't predict who they are, so we have to protect everyone from it. We have tried to incorporate into our education efforts, you know, more stories, more survivor videos and things like that. We haven't gotten to the point of bringing any of our survivors back, but, you know, just to try to get at sort of that balance between the data and the stories, what we know could be the consequences and the personal reflections on what the consequences are. I found and survivor stories, probably a lot coming from you too, where they're actually nurses, like they're nurses who've been ill in the ICU and are saying, yeah, this is all my brain has fallen apart basically toward the end of this. I can't do anything. I can't do my nursing job anymore. Like that really hits home for the nurse standing at the bedside caring for people. So really just trying to connect back to that, including for the residents too, who are also just trying to survive, you know, shift to shift. They don't really know what is the difference between these different sedatives. What is delirium? They don't really know about PICs or other longer term consequences of ICU care decisions. And so really trying to bring that back to why. So whenever I'm going to talk to them about sedatives or antipsychotics or anything like that, I always start with a little bit of the walk through the history of basically the you know, Dr. Ely's group, the different groups that have put the evidence out there. This is what we know. This is the story of the science of what happens to patients if we don't take care. This is how the bundle has been proven to stop that damage and help people live better lives. So this is why we care about all this stuff. It's funny, just today on rounds, the intensivist was asking the residents, you know, about some different interventions with the ventilators, with ventilated patients, such as proning or paralytics, you know, what are the mortality benefits and all that kind of stuff. And I was thinking in my head, and I'm going to have to bring up at rounds tomorrow that, you know, one of the most impressive mortality benefits comes from the ABC trial back in 2008, which was all about spontaneous awakening trials. So if you want to talk about interventions for ventilated patients that are proven to impact mortality, that to me should be number one on the list, because I've challenged the residents, like, show me a better absolute reduction in mortality at 1 year than 14%. 14% more people are alive at the end of 1 year. And the only difference between the groups was the cumulative dose of sedatives as lowered through spontaneous awakening trials done correctly. So, you know, if we're talking about, again, mortality benefits for people on a ventilator, we can't not talk about spontaneous awakening trials, but it was clearly left out of the discussion today on rounds. So my responsibility is going to have to be to bring this up now.
And I mean, I think there is a place for proning. It's, you know, we've seen so many benefits. We also have a study coming out from France, this, I think, coming up this year, showing benefits of VQ mismatch with verticalization.
Okay, awesome.
So we're going to have more proven benefits. We already have lots of proven benefits to lung function, lung aeration, secretion mobilization, things like that for intubated patients with mobilization. But mm-hmm. that gets left out of the conversation when we have sick lungs. Yes. It's really baffling to me. And then, of course, when we have sick lungs, the brain doesn't matter. Everything gets left behind. But it is part of the training. We are trained to think that way. To hone in on those single organs. So everyone, we're all a product of our training and our experiences. So having someone else there to bring in another insight, to bring in the evidence, to bring in more ideas and accountability, to the evidence is really powerful, whether it's psychiatry. I know as a nurse practitioner, that was my role during rounds to say, where are we at with this? How are they sleeping? How's their pain? How's their delirium? I'm seeing some nurse leaders doing that. They're attending rounds very purposefully. They're touring the unit, going around door to door saying, where are we at with this, this, this? I see pharmacists bringing in these elements. Anyone can bring in this discussion during rounds. I think you as a psychiatrist have a very niche expertise as far as the psychiatric and the cognitive big picture of survivorship. But I also, even though I worked in an awakened walking ICU, I used psych all the time. You guys were my go-to with really difficult alcohol or drug withdrawals, with different psychiatric orders, with delirium. I mean, when I hit a wall, even though we had such good protocols and I felt like my NP group, we were experts in a lot of this, we still reached out to psych. So how would you invite the ICU community to involve psychiatric services more?
Yeah, I think a couple of things that I would think of, you know, I see my role in the ICU too. Sometimes I mention is like, we have to get the brain and the lungs to the point of being, of extubation happening at the same time. So a lot of delays is from one or the other kind of lagging behind. Often the lungs get better, but now the brain is way not ready for extubation. So trying to see our efforts as all important at the same time, like you were talking about, not just talking about one organ at a time and forgetting about all the other ones. The other, you know, sort of things that come to mind is I like the term treating agitation more so than this patient needs sedation, because I think that's a little bit clearer about what we're doing. And it kind of helps with like, we need to be providing something to this patient. We need to treat their agitation, anxiety, insomnia, things like that. Versus like, if we talk about it only in terms of sedation, then when we're talking about taking off sedation, it really leaves this feeling of like deprivation. And I think for some members of the team, more so than others, like nurses, are worried that we're depriving patients of something that they should be having if we're not going to do sedation. But it's like, we really need to think about, you know, is there actually an indication for sedation? Okay, if there is, and they're pretty few and far between, then of course we're going to do sedation. If the person's on paralytics, then I shut up about my awakening trials and my all this other kind of stuff. And it's like, yes, -5, that's great for RAS. But if it's not that patient who's got an actual indication for sedation, then we actually should be talking more in terms of what are the specific symptoms and what other kinds of treatments are there besides putting somebody into a coma, right? We treat agitation, anxiety, pain, and all other parts of the hospital where I also go out and see consults without putting people into coma. So even if they are in the SICU and they've just come out of surgery, you know, we have a lot of nurses who believe that these incredibly high opiate administrations are required because they might have pain from their belly surgery or whatever they just had. But we have lots of patients who go through surgery that respond very well to multimodal treatment, right? Who don't have their airway protected, and therefore we cannot just like pour fentanyl into their veins 24/7 to be sure that they don't have pain. So that's where I mean that from my experience treating patients all over the hospital, there's no reason just because the person is located in the ICU that we have to do these other like humongous things, like hitting with a humongous hammer, instead of like looking at what are the symptoms that this person has, even if they're laying in the ICU, right? What can we do to treat and address all of those symptoms? So I think if the, you know, I've tried to come up with some triggers of like, what would be good reasons to have a psychiatrist see a patient. I think if they're on a lot of psychotropic medications at home, that might be a reason too, because that indicates some psychiatric history. Often people can get agitated or out of sorts if they're used to being on these psychiatric medicines at home and then we're not providing them in the ICU. So that can be a thing. Substance abuse and withdrawal is very difficult for teams to figure out what to do, especially if the patient's having pain, especially if they're asking for pain medications, but they have all this other history, you know, how are we managing withdrawal? What other kinds of stuff can we do to help them out with comfort medications and things like that? And definitely, I feel like if the team is having to address agitation with some type of sedative, or my ICU team here will try to address it with antipsychotics to some extent. Then, you know, if we're having to do that, if it's working, great. If it's not working so great, then that might be a reason to ask, you know, psychiatry to take a look at this and see what could be helpful here. So those are the main reasons why I would say, you know, agitation would be a primary reason to get psychiatry involved.
I keep thinking about this culture that I think I've been a part of at times, in which in the ICU, we just assume that because we have the sickest patients that we practice the most complex and advanced medicine, and that there's very little anyone else outside of our club could offer. If that makes sense, right? We think, well, you don't understand because you're used to treating patients on the floor, but our patients are different because they're in the ICU. What I'm understanding is that because you do treat patients as humans, you have to actually communicate with them. You have to find the root cause of the agitation. You do have a whole nother skill set. Whereas in the ICU, I think because we've had sedation at our fingertips all the time, we can mask and mask and mask all of these things without really diagnosing and treating the root causes. So you bring in a whole nother expertise. So there is so much merit in having an objective outside party come in with new eyes, fresh perspective, and a totally different skill set and expertise to bring in those elements into our patients, especially when we don't want to just mask these symptoms. Right. I have an agitation toolkit, and I, you know, we say agitation all the time. You probably can appreciate this. Patient is coming out of an awakening trial. They might be restless. They look uncomfortable, and we call it agitation. But in literature, it is a RASS of greater than 2. This means that they're doing dangerous behaviors or starting to pull out their lines and tubes, and or even a +4 in which they're trying to hurt themselves or others. So that can happen. You've seen it. I've seen it. But a lot of times we're using agitation to describe patients that are restless or trying to pick at things and or look uncomfortable. So my toolkit goes through, what do you do for a RASS of +1 or +2? And then what do you do for a +3 or +4? How do you get them back down to a +1 or +2 and then treat those root causes? So there's so much value in having someone bring in that discussion, that expertise. I would invite everyone to reach out to your psychiatrist in your hospital. I know that psychiatry is usually really busy. I think we hesitate to bother you guys.
I get that a lot, but I'm like, no, please. This is my favorite thing to treat, actually, my favorite thing, because I think, I feel like we can really make a big difference there, and we can think about it maybe a little bit differently than the team is thinking about it. I also think it just makes sense. Everything is so sort of specialized in the field of medicine. You know, there's so many different consultants on these cases, but why not involve the specialists in treating agitation using these different medications, always with the goal, which I sometimes have to like concretely explain to patients, you know, our goal is to have you awake, functional, thinking, communicating, participating in your own decisions, being able to enjoy things that, you know, can be adapted to the hospital, like visiting with your family or reading a book or watching a movie and things like that. So I'm not here to, you know, make you into a zombie or things like this. I run it, you know, psychiatry struggles with a lot of myth and stigma and bias and other things like that. I feel like I am kind of in lockstep with my patients in that way, right? The mental health patients experience a lot of that in the world. Psychiatry experiences a lot of that within the field of medicine. So I'm pretty used to dealing with those kinds of things. But just trying to be very concrete about what the goal is. Why are we using these medications, or why are we using this, that, or the other intervention? Or why are we trying to get to the problem of what's making a person uncomfortable, restless, anxious, agitated, as we say, because we want to return them to a state where they can be comfortable and be participatory in their care and understand what's happening to them and work toward their own recovery, right? I really talk to patients a lot about that. This is like any other kind of endeavor you'd get into as a human being where you're trying to better yourself or heal yourself. We need to participate in movement. We need to take medications or things that are going to help us. We need to be able to eat and nourish ourselves, things like that. So trying to really involve the patient in the process too toward the goal.
Yeah. I'm sure for many listeners, this is a huge shift. Okay. It probably has crossed many people's minds to consult psychiatry for intubated patients.
Yeah.
Maybe certain select patients in the ICU that are more stable or just there for psych specific reasons. But the fact that psychiatry can help get our patients extubated is probably a very unique concept, but it makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It is a unique concept for psychiatry too, I would say. Like your average psychiatrist in a hospital or who works on the inpatient psychiatric unit, you're trying to get them to come to the ICU instead to see a patient up there. They're going to be like, what? No, can they talk? No, call me back when they're extubated and they can talk. You know, that might be, unfortunately, a response that a lot of people have gotten from psychiatry. I would say if you have a consult specialty psychiatry in your hospital, you're less likely to get a reaction like that. But even in the world of psychiatry, you know, the professional organization for consultation liaison psychiatrists, there is a special interest group on critical care within that organization that is trying to educate psychiatrists about how they can help patients in the ICU and what does it take to do that. We have an article coming out in Psychiatric Times, hopefully by the end of this year, that kind of goes over those basics of how to help in the ICU just for psychiatry readership.
And I think we need to allow everyone grace and opportunities to grow and evolve. So some physical therapists are terrified or obstinate to working with patients on ventilators. That doesn't mean we just canceled the program altogether.
Okay. Yes.
But we might need to do some education and say what you do with patients that are not on ventilators, especially applies to patients that are on mechanical ventilation. Mm-hmm. We're going to give you some training and some experience, some exposure, and you're going to see how your skill set can grow, but also what you already have applies here. That might be the same thing for psychiatry. Mm-hmm. Yes. What you already do outside of the ICU is what we need inside the ICU, and you're going to develop ICU specific expertise.
Yes. Yep. Right. You're going to pay attention to, like, can you get pills in this person somehow? Or if not, what else are you going to use? You know, so you're going to get into some of the nuances of treating a patient who can't talk to you. You're going to learn the CAM ICU. I mean, that's validated against psychiatric examinations for delirium, but I use it quite a bit to see if mechanically ventilated patients who can't really talk, if they can pay attention or not. So you get familiar with all the terminology, all the tools, it becomes a lot easier.
Well, thank you so much for everything you're doing there on site and for what you've shared with us. I think this can really open up more support, more options for ICU clinicians. ICU liberation really is interdisciplinary. It just grows and grows. There are so many resources that we have available that we can use if we are really working on the ultimate goal of helping patients survive and thrive during and after the ICU. Thank you so much for everything that you shared, and keep us posted. Let us know how we can infiltrate the psychiatry world more.
Yes, I will keep passing on the podcast, and I very much appreciate all the work and all the help you've given me acclimate to the critical care community, culture, how people think, and where some of the issues might be. So I really appreciate it.
Well, I definitely believe that you are saving lives there. So thank you.
Thank you.
Schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.